Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, Darfur and Christian-Muslim cooperation for peace top the agenda of meetings in the Vatican between the Pope and Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir. Celebrating the old Rite Latin Mass won't be old anymore, and clarifying church doctrine on health care for patients in a vegetative state. It was described as a very respectful meeting. Pope Benedict received in audience Friday the President of Sudan, Omar Hassan al-Bashir. The two met for just under half an hour in the papal summer residence at Castel Gandolfo outside Rome on Friday. President al-Bashir later met with Vatican Secretary of Foreign Affairs, Archbishop Dominique Momberti, formerly the Apostolic Nuncio to Khartoum. Talks focused on the political and religious situation in Sudan, particularly on Darfur, and on the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which had been drawn up to end decades of conflict in southern Sudan. In a statement issued by the Vatican's press office, the Holy See expressed great hope for the success of upcoming peace talks on Darfur, scheduled for October 27th in Libya, so that the suffering and the vulnerability of people in Darfur, it said, will come to an end. The Holy See also expressed its desire to see their right to humanitarian assistance respected and the launch of development projects in Darfur. While other issues raised during the Vatican talks concerned the defense of human life and the family, respect for human rights, such as the fundamental right to religious freedom, the importance of interreligious dialogue, and interfaith collaboration, especially, it said, between Christians and Muslims for the promotion of peace and the common good. Well, it was the very first time the Sudanese president has visited the Vatican. He was accompanied by a ministerial-level delegation, including Sudan's ministers for foreign and religious affairs and members of parliament. Vatican Radio will be speaking with President al-Bashir on Saturday. You'll find excerpts from that interview on our World News Service. You can access that service any time of the day or night on our website. That's www.vaticanradio.org. Well, in the meantime, I spoke with a white father missionary who lived in Sudan for many years. Father Paul Hannon used to teach in Khartoum. He said that while most people hear about the horrible violence going on in Darfur, little attention has been given to important headway Sudan has made in the south and towards economic revival.
We hear a lot of the negative news, but there are also snippets of very positive news, especially, I would say, on the front of interfaith, interreligious encounter and dialogue. And recently, as recent as December of just last year, so only about 8 months ago, a new plot of land was accorded to the Catholic Church in Al-Hajj Yusuf, which is a suburb of Khartoum, for the purpose of building a church. And this is something quite new. It hasn't happened for a very long time in Sudan. So there is something positive. We, as Missionaries of Africa, have a parish in that area, and we tried to acquire a plot for many years so that we could build officially a church in that place. And this met with a lot of difficulties until recently. And there's been, I think, a more positive attitude of the government towards those of other faiths other than Islam. So there is a positive thing that is happening.
What do you think brought that change in attitude towards the Christians?
I think it goes in line a little with the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which was signed with the southern Sudanese after 23 years of civil war. That was signed 2-3 years ago now. And I think there is a slightly less rigid and less strict Islamic tendency on the part of the government in the north. And there's a desire to for them to be seen to be a little more open to others of other faiths who are Sudanese, who are their own compatriots, and who are living with them in the north of Sudan. So I think there was a link with that peace agreement and a desire to be seen to be a little more fair and not so harshly, strictly Islamic than before.
So in what other ways are you seeing this this new positive attitude, if you will, expressing itself in other parts of the country? You mentioned in the south, of course, things are improving. What about the rest of Sudan?
Well, I must say in the south things are improving, but really they were starting from scratch, from nothing, from zero. Because during the years of civil war, there was absolutely no development. All funds were concentrated on military activities, security, armies, etc. So now roads are beginning to be built. There's a more peaceful situation in the south, hospitals, schools. All this has to be planned, funded, and personnel have to be found for all of that. That is a major, huge project for the south. In the north of Sudan, which I've visited recently, signs of economic recovery after all that funding for military activity has ceased. Funds are now going to other projects, road building, hospitals, development, especially around the capital of Khartoum. And there, even some of the southerners who are displaced people living in and around Khartoum find opportunities for jobs, laboring work, etc. In a way, there's a spin-off for them also. And all this money coming from the recently discovered and developed oil installations in the center of Sudan, exploited by Chinese companies and the government of China, helping and sending engineers and technicians to help build pipelines, etc. So there's a spin-off there. Because of the re-established peace in Sudan in the south, there is an economic benefit, I think, for most people, even some of the most disadvantaged and marginalized southerners living in the north.
What would your concerns be then? Is it all a bright, rosy picture?
Not at all, no. It isn't all rosy. I've seen signs of hope, signs of hope. What I think the government of Sudan needs to look at and really consider very seriously is its desire for a peaceful settlement of the Darfur situation in collaboration and cooperation with the different rebel factions which are involved in that conflict. There has to be a desire for peace and a working for peace and a striving for peace. And I think sometimes that has not been very visible from outside. So that's one area. The South has signed a comprehensive peace settlement, but that is for a period of time. There's a kind of interim period now for 6 years after the signing. And after 6 years, a referendum will take place. So there's a certain uncertainty about the future. What will the South decide? Will there be fair a referendum giving everyone an opportunity to express an opinion about either remaining unified as one country or as having a certain autonomy for the South or a complete independence for the South? There are many unknowns and a certain uncertainty which leaves Sudan still in a situation of difficulty, really, I would say.
What do you see as coming out of this meeting between Sudan's president and Pope Benedict? I mean, do you have any hopes of what you would like to see come out of it?
Yes, I would like to see President Bashir expressing a sincere desire, first of all, for peace within all of the frontiers of Sudan, the most vast country in Africa, a huge area, different populations, culturally, linguistically, religious, many differences, but a country which has huge possibilities. And I would like to see him assure Pope Benedict that there is a sincere desire for peace, for justice, for equality for all members of Sudanese society, wherever they are from, whatever their cultural or religious background is, that should be expressed very clearly, and a commitment to work for peace and justice. I was in Sudan when Pope John Paul visited Sudan in 1992 or 93. And that was a great boost to the church, which at that time, still under the civil war situation in the south, felt very much an oppressed minority in the north, under a lot of pressure, suspicion. That has changed. That situation has changed a little. It is not quite so bleak as it was. Things are improving. There is hope for the future.
White missionary Father Paul Hannon speaking to me there ahead of Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir's meeting on Friday with Pope Benedict XVI. Benedict's motu proprio, relaxing restrictions on celebrating the Latin Mass, went into effect on Friday. The Summorum Pontificum allows priests to celebrate the Latin Mass as it used to be performed according to the old 1962 Roman Missal, that is, before the reforms implemented by the Second Vatican Council in 1970 introduced the new rite in the vernacular that we are all familiar with today. That said, it's important to note that the 1962 rite was never abolished, but now it will be easier to participate in an old rite Latin Mass. Under the Pope's motu proprio, in fact, any group of the faithful who wishes to attend the so-called Tridentine liturgy can ask their priest to celebrate the Mass. The difference is he will no longer have to seek his bishop's permission to do so. One exception to that old rule was allowed in England and Wales, where back in 1971, Catholic bishops were given special papal permission to celebrate the Tridentine Mass. Catholic churches across the country have been regularly celebrating the old rite ever since. Westminster Cathedral in London, in fact, offers celebrations of the Tridentine Mass twice a month. The cathedral's administrator, Monsignor Mark Langham, spoke to Susie Hodges, who asked him if the Tridentine Mass has become more popular since the Pope issued his motu proprio.
There hasn't been a great change, really, because we have quite a good provision in the cathedral and in the diocese for the Tridentine Mass, with twice monthly masses here. I think people feel more part of the mainstream, but I'm very much waiting to hear from people, and if they make a request for the Tridentine Mass, if they're regular members of our congregation, then we're very happy to respond to that in the spirit of the Holy Father's motu proprio.
But up to now, has the Tridentine Mass been well attended by people? Is it popular, as far as you can tell, at least amongst the people who are attached to this old rite?
It is popular, very popular. There's a faithful group who have a great love and affection for the Tridentine Mass. It's not a huge group. I'd say it varies between 20 and 40 that we get for our masses each month. It may grow, but I'm ready to wait and see. And if there is a greater need for it, then we'll respond to that.
You talked about between 20 and 40 people on average attending the Tridentine Mass. How does that compare to attendance for the new rite?
Well, our Sunday masses that we have here would be vastly more people, 600 or 700 up to 1,000 at our regular masses. So it isn't a large part of our congregation. But I'm very keen that we cater for them and respond to their pastoral need. They're a faithful group.
All the same, it does seem that on the basis of the figures you've been telling me, that it is still quite a small minority who are attached to the old rite.
In our experience, yes, that's so. There are 8 other churches in our diocese that celebrate the Tridentine Mass regularly, so the numbers are not negligible. But in terms of our pastoral provision, it isn't a large group. And the Holy Father himself does make the point that provision of the Tridentine Mass must be harmoniously reconciled with the pastoral care we give to the parish as a whole. So we would see it as part of the provision that we provide for many smaller groups in the cathedral community.
Any particular interesting feedback from the faithful, you know, after the motu proprio was announced?
Yes, a lot of response. I think people in general are very happy, very delighted. Those who are attached with great affection to the Tridentine Mass have been very, very happy. And I think it's a feeling that they are recognized as part of the mainstream community, and that their love and desire to celebrate Tridentine Mass is now something that can be fully acknowledged as part of the parish communities that they're in. So I think they're delighted, and I haven't had very much negative response to it at all.
John Newton is editor of the Catholic book publisher Baronius Press, the global publisher of the church-approved 1962 Latin Missal. They sell thousands of Tridentine Mass missals every year, but Newton says sales have doubled since Pope Benedict's motu proprio was announced this past July. Newton told Susie Hodges that many of his customers appear to be young people.
It's very true that most of our sales are via the internet, and certainly the feedback that we get from customers does seem to suggest to us very strongly that a great number of our customers are of the generation that was born after the council.
And how did you feel personally when Pope Benedict passed his motu proprio on this?
Personally, I was absolutely elated. I think this could potentially transform the quality of liturgy in the church in an absolutely unprecedented way.
Do you yourself attend celebrations of the Tridentine Mass?
I usually attend the current rite, the missal authorised by Paul VI, at my local parish as a matter of course. But if I'm up in London, I usually do try and make it to one of the various weekday celebrations of the old Latin Mass, which are available.
And when you go to celebrations of the Tridentine Mass, say during your visits to London, do you notice the age group or the ethnicity of the people attending the Mass?
Yes, and what surprises me is that it's a very mixed congregation. For example, I remember attending the Easter celebrations at Corpus Christi in Covent Garden last year. And in terms of ethnicity, it was a very mixed congregation. In terms of age range, most of the people attending appeared to be of my generation, between 18 and 35. So it's not the sort of white, middle-class, elderly congregation that you might necessarily presume is attending these sorts of masses.
Now, you say that you attend normally the new rite, but mm-hmm. What is it that you particularly like about the old rite? And if it were more readily available, would you tend to prefer that, or do you just like to sort of enjoy both?
That's a good question. Certainly, I think that the older missal is very beautiful, it's very reverent, and certain features such as the silent canon give it a much more meditative sense than the new rite. And if the old rite was available locally, I certainly would attend that a lot more frequently than I do. I'm not sure I'd exclusively attend the old rite, because I suppose having grown up with the new rite, I'm very fond of that as well. But yes, I certainly do feel that the old rite has an awful lot to offer in terms of worship.
And do you think it will, you know, even though it's still going to remain the preference of a minority of the faithful, that it will slowly but gradually increase in popularity now?
I think it will.
John Newton there is editor of the Catholic book publisher Baronius Press. He was speaking to my colleague Susie Hodges. The Vatican has issued further clarifications on the Church's position regarding the health care of patients who are in a so-called vegetative state. The clarifications come in response to two questions submitted by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. The questions concern the provision of food and water to these patients, mostly administered by artificial means. Given the enormous burden this places on families and on the health system, the bishops wanted further clarification on whether or not church doctrine considers such treatment extraordinary or disproportionate, and thus not a moral obligation. The Undersecretary for the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, Father Joseph Augustine de Noia, explained the church's guidelines to Charles Collins.
Essentially, the occasion for it was an address of John Paul II to the participants in a congress in 2004 on life-sustaining treatments, in which the then Holy Father stated that nutrition and hydration ought not to be considered extraordinary means, but should be understood as the normal care, feeding and providing essential liquids is part of normal care of a person who is in a persistent vegetative state. The American bishops, responding to questions that arose about this address, formulated questions which they sent to us in 2005, a year later. And the question was, did this teaching of John Paul II represent a development or a change in this teaching of the Church going back to the time of Pius XII. And so we gave the matter a thorough study, consulting, you know, experts and, you know, giving it the complete treatment because of its importance that these sorts of issues should get. The response has been, first of all, that what John Paul II said in that discourse in 2004 does not represent a change, but is simply continuous with the Church's teaching, and there is a commentary that accompanies these two simple responses, which cites the various documents that have come from the Holy See in that time, confirming that nutrition and hydration, even when provided by artificial means, are not necessarily, therefore, extraordinary means. However, we do say in the commentary that in places where this technology, although it's practically universal, where it may not be possible to provide it, then, of course, we could not oblige the impossible in those locations wherever they might be.
Can you tell us what we mean when we say extraordinary means?
I suppose there are two things that have to be said. The first thing is that a person in a persistent vegetative state is not actually dying in that sense any more than any of us. And you could say we're all eventually going to die, but the person in a persistent vegetative state does not have a condition which makes death imminent or immediate, whereas the withdrawal of food and liquids would, in fact, cause death. So in that sense, it's not an extraordinary, but simply an ordinary and proportionate means. You continue to provide the nutrition necessary for a person who retains his or her dignity despite this failure in their overall health. They are not terminal, but they need to be provided this assistance. And the second point is that nutrition and hydration are not extraordinary means, technical means, that are introduced simply to prolong life, where it would imminently come to an end by its natural course because of some illness. So that people will frequently say, well, please do not, you know, resuscitate me, or please do not, at the end of my life, allow a great deal of technology to be used to keep me alive when I would simply die peacefully. So in that sense, the church is not here enjoining an kind of excessive prolongation of life, but simply saying that to withdraw nutrition and hydration is to end a life that would otherwise continue naturally.
You mentioned human dignity. Many people will often use that phrase, quality of life, and that's one reason that they think that hydration and nutrition should be removed is because the quality of life of someone who's in a vegetative state is not a life worth living. What's your response to someone who says that?
Right. That's a very good question. And in fact, what we're saying here is that the quality of life is not a judgment that you might say is in our hands to make. Life is a gift from God, and the church has consistently taught that it is a gift that is not subject to the determination and decision, really, of anyone, including the person himself or herself who is ill. So the dignity of the human person perdures through all of their physical development. So an infant who in a certain sense one could say has a very limited quality of life, as if that were some abstract standard, nonetheless possesses, indeed, the infant in the womb already possesses. So the human person is from the Catholic point of view, if I may use a big word, ontologically constituted as to possess a dignity which perdures through all of the various physical states which each person experiences in life, from the existence in the womb to the final moments before death. At no point can life be terminated for any reason. I mean, innocent life, now, we're not, without getting into the whole issue of self-defense and war. The dignity of the human person perdures throughout all of the physical states that transpire in a person's life, from the womb until natural death.
Father Joseph Augustine de Noia is the Undersecretary for the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. He was speaking there to my colleague, Charles Collins. That concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.